I'm Afshin Rattansi, and a big welcome back to Going Underground. After 10 months off air, we're no longer in Censor City, London, and instead coming to you from the heart of the Middle East, Dubai, after UK and EU press freedom restrictions made it difficult for us to bring you the stories, truth and balance you want to hear. Much has happened since we've been away, but the NATO proxy war on Russia through Ukraine still rages on. Now coming back to join me from Rome to talk about the global transformation we are witnessing is the guest of our last show almost a year ago. Alistair Crook was a top advisor to the EU's de facto foreign minister. He advised the EU's High Representative for Common Foreign and Security Policy. He's the founder of NGO Conflicts Forum. Thanks so much, Alistair, for coming back on before we were rudely interrupted. I better just ask you, before we get into any of the geopolitical issues, what you make of the levels of censorship. I know you're in Rome, but across Europe and, well, to an extent, the United States does have a First Amendment. There are voices of dissent there, but on the European continent?
European continent, it's terrible. It's a complete suffocation of speech. There's one narrative allowed and only one narrative, and everything else is filtered out. The press is much more controlled overall, the whole European press. I'm not talking about the UK or further afield. The press has its speaking notes, sticks to it rigorously. Everything is controlled. You can't step out of line. You say the wrong thing. Someone says the wrong thing on a television channel, they lose their job. Very, very strict press control here.
I mean, Britain, of course, has previously banned RT, CGTN, Press TV, a whole plethora of different channels. The European Union called to ban CGTN, the Chinese television channel. Just a second off the media. I mean, your equivalent now advising Josep Borrell, the Dalian foreign minister, the EU equivalent foreign minister. I mean, surely they realise the importance of at least listening to all sides before making decisions on important strategic decisions on issues that affect mortality in the EU this winter, let alone any geopolitical considerations.
No, I don't think they do. And I don't think they do it because there's a real sense here in Europe and in Brussels that the narrative must be maintained at all costs, that if the narrative fails, then they fail, then the West fails, our democracy fails. So the narrative, and if you like, undermining and trashing the narrative of anyone else has become so important. It's all about this hegemony of narrative and that we must keep it. But it's actually not working. I mean, it's very obvious if you look at the world around us that that they see the narrative doesn't work. And they see it because things are changing in the rest of the world. And people are starting to say, well, you know, you, Europe, you're just one voice. You're just one civilization. But there's China and there's India and there's Iran and there's Russia. And, you know, you only speak for yourselves. Don't try and speak for us. We don't want you to speak for us. Your problems are not the world's problems, and we are our own side. We're not pro you or against you. We just want to be ourselves with our own values and our own standards. And so this is really threatening to the West because they feel that if they lose the sense that their way of doing things, their way of politics, their way of economic equals the vision of the future for the rest of the world. If that starts to fail and come collapse, then it's over. The Western hegemony is gone. So there's this great emphasis. So they don't want to check. In fact, I think they prefer not to check, to cross-check, to counterbalance what they hear from one side with looking and looking and hearing from another, as one used to do, because the narrative has to prevail. And so even if it's patently false, even if the lies are so obvious that it's almost ridiculous, they stick with the narrative. And the strange thing is that they're not conscious that the rest of the world sees this and laughs. And they say, you know, you're bizarre. You've become so weird in the West. I mean, you're completely tied up with your narratives and your squabbles. And we're laughing at you, and we don't want your narrative because we've moved to a different paradigm of civilizational states. And, you know, our voices out there, and your voice is just one voice, and it's not universal.
Yeah, I want to get on to the conversations in Bali at that G20 summit where the vast majority of humanity are away from Europe. But I don't know how expensive the Delacroix were that you talked with Javier Solana in Brussels and so on. But how do you square all of what you've just said with the fact that enlightenment values, per se, are so often quoted in the academy in European capitals, let alone the fact that it's our way of life, the rules-based order, but they draw back, they say, to the Enlightenment and, I don't know, Thomas Paine or ideas of freedom, of expression and freedom generally.
Mm. You know, after the Second World War, there was a sense that they were quite persuasive that the Enlightenment values. But I think what's happened now in the world at large, the rest of the world, is a sense of understanding that really it was something of a sham, because these values that are projected have become rather abstract, if you like. It's become an operating system, an operating political system, quite a cynical operating system, and quite a cynical economic system. And that they see that this was a product of a particular European period of thinking. I mean, we're talking about Adam Smith, John Locke, Newton. I mean, this individualism, this was the era of individualism. And that grace. And the other thing with the Enlightenment that we thought, Europe thought that because it was distinctly secular, then it was neutral. And everyone would see it was therefore neutral. But that's not true for the Muslim world. It's not true in India. It's not true in China in many ways either. They see secularism as a particular product, a product of Western thinking, and inimical to spirituality, to religious, even in Russia, to the revival of the Orthodox Church, which is so important. And they understand that you cannot get back energy into your society, into your community, without some understanding beyond just the literal, of moving beyond that. You have to have the narratives, the myths, the stories, the moral stories that give your community meaning and give it a certain depth. And without that, you have nothing except the sort of the descent into nihilism and cynicism. And this is the danger of inheriting the sort of nihilism that grew up in the West in the interwar period, as a danger to all civilizational states who still have, you know, a past, who have values, a legacy that they've taken from the past, and which sort of gives, reinvigorates and reignites their civilizations. So that secularism is now seen to be very much a tool of the West for hegemony. I mean, there are many secular people, but they don't like the sort of enforced secularism of the Enlightenment any longer. I mean, secularism can be a choice, but it's not something that they want to see enforced and embedded in the global order today.
Well, I mean, I would say that they probably do have identity politics as a replacement to that origin story, but then they don't seem to remember how many LGBTQ plus people they've killed in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, and elsewhere, right, arguably. But then you mentioned President Xi, and I don't know whether you heard the latest British Prime Minister forcefully saying the golden age is over with China. It seems that they want not one fight with Moscow, but definitely China is the bigger deal. Why would the strategists in Europe feel that this is in any way, whether it's Clausewitz war theory or whatever, a good way of charting the future now that they've lost their energy supplies and, of course, their mobile phones the components come from China?
They don't. They don't think that. They are just pawns in this game. They don't have any agency, they don't have any ability. And what I think we're seeing very clearly is that the United States is prepping Europe, and we saw that exactly with that speech you say you described at the Mansion House by the UK Prime Minister. We see it with Macron and in Europe, where they're heating up the language that they wish to use with China about human rights, about that identity politics that you just described, which of course is an anti-culture culture rather than being a culture culture. So they're heating this up. And the aim, I think, is very clear. They're going to try and force, and will succeed in forcing Europe to cut with China in trade and economic means altogether, impose the same sort of isolation as they see it on Russia. Of course, Russia isn't isolated at all, but to, from their perspective, put up another, if you like, iron curtain, not just with Russia, but with trade with China. A little bit at the edges, maybe, but nothing substantial, nothing strategic. China is out. And America, this austerity, the strange austerity that is being advocated by, you know, Conservative Party in the UK. I mean, the Conservative Party, UK is going into a recession, clearly. And so what do they want? You know, to cut services, to increase tax. I mean, it's just like Greece in 2008. I mean, imposing austerity in order to force Europe, now having abandoned, having lost, if you like, its supplies of raw materials and energy from Russia, is now to lose the technology and the markets of China, and to reconcile itself to being, if you like, just a field in which the United States can come and pluck industries which are no longer competitive, and moving across to the United States. I saw a news item the other day that one in four German industries are considering now in transferring production somewhere else because they're just no longer competitive when their energy costs are so high compared to the energy costs in the United States or in Asia or in certainly let alone Russia. I mean, they are astronomical now. And so industry is going to be removed, and the reindustrialization of the United States is going to come out of the bones of a rather smaller and rather diminished Europe.
Alistair Crook, I'll stop you there. More from a top advisor to the EU's High Representative for Common Foreign and Security Policy after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with former British diplomat and founder of Conflicts Forum, Alistair Crook. You seem to be presenting it like the European leaders are some sort of ISIS in the sense that they're so fundamentalist about destroying their entire way of life. I mean, the ambulance drivers are on strike, I understand, in Britain. That's what Britain has to look forward to this winter. Where does this rigidity come from?
I think I wouldn't describe them as ISIS, but are they, you know, zealots on Ukraine? I mean, all you hear about this is Ukraine as a symbol for European values. Well, anyone who knows Ukraine would find that connection as sort of Ukraine as a sort of paragon of democracy and lack of corruption rather strange and bizarre. But it's not about that. I mean, it's a war on Russia. Again, another war on Russia to add to a long list of European contentions. And it's pursued, of course, by the principally by the Anglosphere against Russia, and is, in a sense, deeply at the bottom, at the deeply about the fact that Russia is returning to orthodoxy. And it is, in a sense, that old war of the, if you like, the 30-year war in which Protestantism scored this great victory over Orthodox Catholic thinking. And now here Russia is coming back with values, with traditions, with ideas. There was a senator, I can't remember his name, but there was a senator recently in the U.S., who said, we have to continue and destroy Russia because it is becoming an orthodox power again. So there's something under the surface to this that needs to be sort of examined a little further, to why is it so intense, the need to sanction and destroy? And of course, this was the biggest intelligence failure ever in this era, because the intelligence services told the European leaders, listen, it's slam dunk. It's easy. Just put all these sanctions on them and Russia will collapse and there'll be political chaos in Moscow and they'll force Putin out. And then in a month or two, you can go back to getting cheap energy from a compliant new leadership in Moscow when we've got rid of this gang there. I mean, they really bought into this. They believed that, you know, these sanctions, it would just collapse within a very short time, and then we could all go back to normal and get cheap energy and it would be done. I mean, they didn't. I mean, they bought into the idea that, you know, that somehow Russia was, you know, this gas station in the desert and nothing more, and a tiny economy, when it isn't at all. It's probably a bit bigger than Germany's economy. It's not, you know, the size of New York State or something like that, as they try and say. But this has been the narrative, and the Western leaders just took it and accepted it, and now have got themselves painted into a double corner. They haven't got energy. Their industry is going to be wholly uncompetitive. And now with this Reduction of Inflation Act in the United States, which gives subsidies to companies moving to the United States that use American components and input, they're going to lose their industry too. I mean, you couldn't get a worse situation that they've put themselves into. And for sure, this is going to lead to contraction of the economy, contraction of employment, and really a catastrophic economic situation coming.
Well, the way you've painted it, as Russia, in effect, destroys, annihilates the European Union, it has been helped hugely by alliances in the Global South and, of course, with the BRICS countries and other Shanghai Cooperation Organization countries. Has it surprised you, this ability now to laugh, not quite laugh, but withstand US Treasury sanctions, which were the ultimate power? I know, you know, Cuba obviously has withstood them so many years. Iran has withstood them. But has it surprised you?
But I first want to just take issue and say, you know, the Europeans did this to themselves. I mean, you know, Russia didn't put the sanctions on them. They sanctioned Russia at the behest of Washington and against the advice of the Federal Reserve, as I understand it, and against the advice of other banks to do this, to sanction this Russian central bank. They did this in the misguided expectation that this was going to be an easy victory for Europe. It's turned out to be anything but that. Now, yes, I think, I mean, it was quite clear this was all predicated on the sort of plan of 1997, which nearly worked in destroying the Russian economy. There was a run on the ruble. They destroyed the financial system. There was, if you like, turmoil in Moscow. But out of that turmoil arose Putin. And he spent his time making the Russian economy self-sufficient. He spent time in changing and reforming the economy. And the West didn't notice, and they didn't check. They didn't do their homework. They didn't think this through before they dived in on the, Panglossian idea that they could just bring down Russia. I mean, the European Union, we're so great, we can bring down, we're now an empire, we can bring down Russia by our economic power. In the end, it's bringing down Europe. But Russia didn't do it. We did it to ourselves.
But on the other hand, as this decline operates at a hastening pace this winter, the deaths in Britain, excess deaths, what, tens of thousands of people, as the lights go out in across monuments, let alone in the houses of the poor in European countries, can the media attenuate any opposition to power so that the peoples of Europe will blame Moscow rather than blame their own governments for destroying their livelihoods?
Oh, that's going to be, of course, I mean, repeated every time. You can't listen to a speech without, you know, the Putin energy, the Putin's food hostage, making us hostage on food. Every time it's, you know, Putin's inflation, Putin's energy crisis, of course. But I think, I mean, the
will
real,
it work?
The role, no. It's certainly not going to work because it's going to be really severe, this crisis. And this is why they're trying to protect themselves, because, you know, the narrative, the European Union narrative is collapsing, not just the Western one, because the European Union narrative has been that Europe has agency because it is a big economy. It can deal on an equal footing with the United States, with China and Russia. And now this is exposing it as complete nonsense. It just has to do what Washington tells it to do. It is just, I mean, they, as one French commentator put it, we are just the vassals of Washington. And it's now apparent, and I think Europeans will be angry. But the role and the purpose of the European political class will be to make sure these protests don't get traction. They will be dealt with severely. So we need to bear that in mind when people are criticizing anything that's happening elsewhere in the world. There were about all the protests that have been so far held in Europe have been met quite severe and quite violent action by police forces to stop them. They're going to try, and they are confident that they can keep control in these means. I doubt it. I'm not so sure.
Well, Britain is restricting protest rights, but isn't there life in the old hegemon yet, in the sense that American diplomats can tell their European counterparts, look, we are striking deals in the global south. If you watch a UN meeting live on a streaming service, you'll see that there are countless proxy global south nations only too willing to bow down to everything that Washington says. Often they have US bases there. I mean, Maduro seems to have been welcoming Chevron back, Pakistan. I think Imran Khan was saying in a Financial Times article, you know, US relationships are important. Isn't there life, I mean, if Europe is gone, isn't there life in those global south alliances still? Can they still not be bought off rather than seeing that China is the new power of the century?
I think they've lost it. And I think they've lost it even in Latin America, which you just quoted, because if you extract Mexico from the statistics, because Mexico is rather a special case, it's sort of almost integrated into the US economy. Take out Mexico, and then you'll find the trade, the overwhelming trade is with China and not with the United States. The China is largest trading partner with the global south, not the United States, even in their backyard. So that is the case. But this, what you've just said about, isn't there some sort of life in the old hegemon? No. Look what's happening. The map is changing. It's really moving. I mean, there's a rush towards the BRICS, to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Countries, Saudi Arabia, India, South Africa, Turkey, all these big, powerful states are moving into the Eurasian project and are not accepting and are very deliberately snubbing. And that's what happened in the G20. They snubbed the G7 when they tried to insist, you know, that they had to isolate Russia and condemn it from Ukraine. They got none of that through in the final communique at all. They didn't succeed in dividing China from Russia. They were desperate to get China to criticize Russia. It didn't happen. Time and time again, Xi just said, you know, no.
What pressure? You mentioned Saudi Arabia. It's, I don't know, redolent of the 70s, the response of Saudi Arabia and the UAE, where I'm speaking to you from, when they angrily denounced the United States trying to call on increases in production. They angrily denounced here in the UAE a fake news Wall Street Journal article that, in fact, it was all agreed they were going to increase oil production. What pressure can Biden put on the GCC countries as they appear to not be doing what they're told?
Well, they tried to do that. They tried to do that very clearly. Biden gave his instructions about how they wanted the price of oil to come down. And the Saudis effectively thumbed their nose at him. And it was a snub that was seen across the Middle East. And so what's going to happen this month? President Xi is going to come to Riyadh. The first trip he's made, I think, other than to Samarkand. And he's going to come to Riyadh for meetings with MBS and also with the Gulf Cooperation Council. I think it'll be a major meeting, and we will have to see what comes from it.
And just finally, I know you've written about this, and I know that President Assad of Syria surprisingly visited Abu Dhabi and Dubai. Who would have thought? We did one of the exclusive world interviews in the middle of the Syrian so-called civil war, or rather NATO proxy war. You talk about how there are trucks with the Russian Z symbol on, banned in Europe, as I understand it, where Joe Biden's military are stealing oil from the Syrian people.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is right. They are. And, you know, there is a sense that people have come to understand this, if you like, this resistance against the Western narrative that our way of doing things has to be your way of doing things, and that's your vision for the future, full stop. And it's getting a sort of general, it's picking up the iconography from Ukraine. And it's called, you know, World Order Z, to represent the fact that this is a thumbing of the nose at the Western hegemony, a resistance. I mean, not a militarized resistance, but a political resistance against the idea that the West defines and sets and implements a global order for the rest of the world.
Alistair Crook, thank you. And that's it for the show. We'll be back next week with another brand new episode. But until then, you can still keep in touch with us via all our social media if it's not censored in your country. But you can always head to the channel Going Underground TV on rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you very soon.